Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Football and Feelings, the podcast that uses football as a common interest to get people to open up about the ups and downs that they experience in life. It's been quite a while since I've done one of these episodes, but I'm back today doing an episode with Malaysian international Junior Eldstal. He plays in Thailand at the moment. He's played in England non-league before moving to Malaysia to play professionally. He's a really nice guy, top guy. He's got a YouTube channel now called The Honest Footballer, which I'd recommend you search it on the socials and on YouTube as well. He talks about the ups and downs of his career. You get to see a really unique insight that a lot of players don't want to show you, what it's like not being picked, what it's like chasing contracts when you're alone and you're leaving your family. You've got to make sacrifices and things like that. As you can probably tell, a lot of our thoughts combine here. It was definitely a collaboration that needed to be done. So I'll leave it there. Enjoy the podcast. Cheers. Okay, Junior, thank you so much for joining me today on the Football and Feelings podcast. We're in very different time zones, but I'm buzzing we've been able to get it in.
Yeah, cheers for that, mate. Yeah, sorry I was a bit late. Obviously, I was trying to rush back from training. Only 45 minutes, but that's in Thai time, that's early. So I'm technically on time.
Yeah, that is true. I want to start with a very simple but important question. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, mate. I'm good. Obviously, I'm in pre-season now and the season was going to start in August. And because of COVID, it's been pushed back. So like a 1 month pre-season's ended up being a 2 month pre-season. So I'm feeling it a little bit now. It's very strenuous sort of doing so much. There's only so much of pre-season you can do before sort of getting bored and, you know, football without actually match time and game time, you know, that's what we train for. That's what we play for. So without the games and stuff, it's quite difficult mentally, but I mean, it's nice. You know, I could be in worse places. I'm right on the beach and sun's out, so
yeah, lovely stuff. And what's the situation in Thailand with like playing in front of fans? Are fans allowed in stadiums yet? Or
nah. I mean, towards the back end of last season, we had 25% capacity, which was nice. And then things were going well, to be fair. And then I don't know what sort of happened, but COVID started peaking again, sort of last 2 months, and they've just locked it back down. So obviously, restaurants and stuff are shut; can't go out. And then now it's back to closed games. And I think they're in discussion at the minute because the league's going to start on the 3rd of December. But I think they're discussing putting it in a bubble. So that's going to be, again, a bit tough.
Yeah,
full on lockdown, just football. So we'll see, mate. We'll see. I think they've got a meeting on Monday next week to finalise it. So we'll see.
Fair enough. Yeah, we'll find that soon. Let's get into it then. Starting with carrying on with the focus on football. What's your first memory of the sport? Was it always a big thing for you growing up?
Growing up, I was actually more into tennis growing up. So I played tennis a lot at school and it was sort of going from school. Obviously, I grew up in Sweden for 5 years before moving to England. I sort of moved to England when I was in year one at school and I was sort of brought up on quite a lot of tennis. And then as soon as I moved back to England and sort of joined school in England, everyone was speaking about football and everyone had like local teams and stuff. And I felt a bit left out. So I said to my dad, I said, oh, can I join the local team, et cetera? And he brought me down to a local club called Guildford Saints in Surrey. And that was my first memory. I started off in the C team in Guildford Saints and then worked my way up to the A team. And that was my first memory, sort of like seven aside, going there on a Saturday, playing Sundays. It was good.
Class. And by the time you were, like you said, by the time you were like 9 or 10, weren't you living in your third country by that point?
Yeah. So I was born in Malaysia and then moved to Sweden for 5 years. And then when I was 6 or 7, I moved to England. Yeah. So it was a bit of transitioning was weird. But, you know, you're at such a young age, you sort of don't really think about it, to be fair. But it was good for me because, you know, I learned all different cultures. And by the time I was in England, I managed to, you know, I could speak English, Swedish and Malaysian as well. So it was nice.
Yeah, that's not bad. Yeah, not bad at all. That do you
multilingual?
Yeah, just a bit. Yeah, do you sway towards like identifying as one of these nationalities? Because like I've seen you supporting the Swedish national team, the English team, but also you're playing for Malaysia.
Yeah, no, it's hard, mate. It's hard. I'd say I support Sweden. Sweden is my number one country that I support, but they don't tend to do too well. So it's good to have England have only sort of recently started doing well, but yeah. It's good to have both. But if Sweden were to play England, I'd always support Sweden first.
Fair enough. Well, is there a language that you're best in out of the three?
English, yeah. English goes number one. I lost my Malaysian for ages. It was funny when I was growing up, I was embarrassed of like being able to speak languages. I don't know what it was in school. Like I was just embarrassed to be able to, you know, to tell them, oh yeah, I can speak Malaysian and stuff. I was embarrassed to be like from another country. It was weird. I think, you know, socially in school and stuff, and you're scared of being bullied and stuff, all this, you know, stuff comes into it. So I sort of stopped speaking Malaysian for a long time, and I sort of forgot how to speak it. And it was only until I moved back to Malaysia to play professionally was when I was like, I need to pick this back up again so I can understand what the other players are saying about me.
Yeah. Let's start with your youth career and our earlier playing days. You played with Aldershot, Reading. How did you find it coming through like these sort of youth systems? Was it like a brutal environment as a kid, or was it still pretty fun?
For me, my youth career was really good. You know, I had great coaches I was working with, especially at Aldershot. Reading was sort of, it was more of a trial sort of stint mode that I had there, which is obviously a lot more competitive. But my time at Aldershot, you know, it was great memories. You know, I had great, great youth team coaches, even before Aldershot, for a team in Burpham, a coach called Dean Hollands. You know, he just loved football. You know, I think it's one of the good things about England grassroots football is you get coaches who literally love and breathe football, and they'll do anything to get the boys on the Saturday mornings and stuff and put on great sessions. And you know, that's how you develop as a player, to enjoy it first before, you know, anything else. And obviously then I had my dad who do extra sessions with me after school, etc. Like only use your left foot, so on. I remember there were sessions where he'd say I was only allowed to use my left foot on a few sessions just to make sure I was both footed. But you know, no, it was all great memories. You know, competitive, obviously very competitive in England because you've got such a number of players that are trying to break through the footballing pyramid. So it's always difficult, but you know, I relished in school and I enjoyed it a lot. Which is obviously like the main thing I'd say as any young kid is to enjoy it and love it before, you know, before anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can tell it's dinner time in your household, by the way. I can hear the plates being knocked about.
Yeah, no, Daisy's eating her food, a salad in the background.
In those years, were you able to like to take your studies seriously at all? Was like education a big thing in your household, or was you more focused on a career in football?
No, I had quite a good balance, to be fair. Like my parents were very supportive on either side, and you know, the school I went to, you know, I represented my county, etc. at the time, and you know, there's obviously the perks of being able to leave class and stuff for training early.
Yeah, waving to your mates off.
Yeah, see you later, mate. I'm off. You know, that's always a good thing. But you know, I think I had quite a good balance, and I was quite lucky enough to, you know, my parents were very supportive on both sides, and as long as I had a good balance between both, they were happy. So as long as I didn't let my school sort of, you know, I wasn't excellent at school, but you know, I managed to pass at least 10 GCSEs, which I don't know if that means anything now, but you know, so many entrepreneurs and stuff.
Yeah, fair enough. And you were playing at Slimbridge in non-league before, like you said, you decided to take the opportunity to play in Malaysia. Now, a lot of players are more open to the idea of playing abroad these days, I think. And the difference in interest can be crazy. Like you could be playing in front of, I don't know, like 40,000 people in one country, but then 200 in another, just depending on the football culture and how it pans out with the locals and like the different levels that they have. So how did this opportunity come about?
Yeah, funny story, actually. So after Aldershot, I joined Farnborough first team, and I was sort of in and out with the first team in the reserves, and I took a big injury to my left ankle. I tore like three ligaments. I was 18 at the time, and I was like, it was getting at a stage in my life where I either stopped football and start working full-time and trying to make money, you know, by labouring, etc. A lot of my mates were doing, like getting electrician scholarships, etc. And my mum actually enrolled me at a uni. So she enrolled me at a university, UWE, Bristol of University, without me knowing. And I thought I was going to Bristol UWE. And I ended up, we were driving to Bristol and then we took like a detour and it was towards Gloucester. And I was like, hang on a minute, like, where are we going? And it was a sports, it was sort of sports university. So Bristol UWE, they've got like a sports hub at Hartbury, which is near Gloucester, which they focus on football, rugby, and equestrian. So it's like a sports university where you do your degree and you're training full time as a professional. So, you know,
so the setup, I'll get into the equestrian. It's time for that career.
Yeah, I'll get on the back of a horse. Exactly. Yeah. So I turned up at Hartbury, man. I was like, I was so surprised at the facilities, the pitches, you know, carpet. And so I enrolled at Hartbury University as part of the football scholarship program. And they've got three teams, you know, A, B and C, first, seconds and thirds, and you sort of work your way up. And, you know, we were training five times a week, playing against different academies. And then you can have the choice to play for a Saturday team as well. So Slimbridge had a good relationship with the university, and it was like 5 minutes down the road from where I was living in Gloucester. So I played for Slimbridge on a Saturday and then Hartbury University on the weekdays. And then on the first year of Hartbury, you had to do like a work experience, sort of get your hours in. And my mum again said, why don't you go to Malaysia? And, you know, we've got a good family friend, Scott Laurentshaw, who's got his own sort of sport and tourism business over there. So, you know, he can take you and your mate Max and you can go over there, sort of have a holiday. He'll write your hours off. You know, say you've done 300 hours and you've probably only done two. Yeah, exactly. So I went over there, done this, done our hours, had a great holiday. And Scotty said to me, do you fancy playing futsal? One night, you know, a couple of guys have played, you've got a futsal game, a bunch of fans are coming. I was like, yeah, why not? So me and Max, my mate, we played. And he turns around to me after, goes, oh, mate, you've got a bit, haven't you? You can play, can't you? That's my best Australian accent right there. You can play. He said, do you fancy, have you ever thought about coming to Malaysia? And I said, nah, not a chance. Like, what, Malaysia? Is there even a league in Malaysia? He said, look, come to the game tonight at Sabah. We've got a Super League game. They were in the Super League at the time, and just get a feel of it. And you can see, turn up at the stadium, like you said, 30,000 fans. I was like, what on earth is this? Mm. You know, and the standard weren't bad. Like, I looked at it and I was like, this is actually a not bad standard. And I fancied myself. And he said, do you still have your Malaysian passport? And I said, yeah, I did at the time, because my mum managed to keep my Malaysian passport since I was very young. So I was very, very fortunate with that. So I went back, and Scott said, back to uni. And the transfer window in Malaysia starts in January. So the season starts in Feb and then ends in November. So it works sort of differently to the UK. So go back to uni. So I went back in September, sort of had 4 months there, spoke to the sporting director, Tom Radcliffe, said, look, I might have an opportunity to go play professional abroad. Will I be able to defer my course to then come back and do my exams, et cetera, later? He said, yeah, absolutely. You know, because it's obviously a good thing for the university to have a player go and sign pro. So got the call in Jan. He said, you've got two weeks to come out. You'll have a trial. Packed my bags, mate, and I was gone. Only packed one bag. Didn't think anything much of it. Had a week trial. And that was it. Signed my six-month deal first, pro. You know, played straight away and sort of moulded in after 4 or 6 months. So I got called up to the national team. Played Chelsea, played Barcelona in the summer. And then that was it. That was, yeah, it was just so crazy how quick it happened.
To the deep end, that, isn't it?
Mate, literally, it was so crazy how it happened. But, you know, when you're a young boy now, I spoke to a lot of my mates and stuff. Like, my agent, you know, Scott then became my agent at the time. And he said, you know, you can either be a small fish in a big pond in the UK or be a big fish in a small pond. And, you know, at the time I was turning 21, I was 20. And, you know, there was like, you know, after Hartbury, do I then go into league football, conference football and try and break through, you know, like a lot of my mates are? Or do I take this opportunity and chuck myself in a deep end and, you know, go heads on with it? And I think in life, when you take these opportunities, you know, they'll always come back around for you in a positive way.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds like it would have been quite a difficult decision to make at some points, though. But I imagine Malay culture was something you were sort of quite familiar with, like you said, like you mentioned. So how did you deal with that transition to playing in the UK, to playing over there? Were there differences in football culture that maybe you didn't realise?
Yeah, like obviously in the mannerisms of training and stuff, you know, I'd say it's a lot less competitive in training. You know, I remember in training in the UK, I'd fight my mates and stuff, you know, even in kickball, you know, my best mates, you know, were getting scraps and stuff. But I think the culture in Malaysia is a lot more relaxed in training. You know, they don't sort of give 100, 110%. The games, I'd say, are a lot less physical, but a lot more technical. So, you know, it's your touches have to be better, etc. And it's a lot more technical and you're playing against good foreigners, but it's a lot less physical. And I think that's where I sort of built this stature in Malaysia of being this, you know, CDM sort of brick house that used to just smash people.
Yeah, I imagine, like, physically, I imagine there was a difference between, like, you and the average sized Malay player.
Yeah, exactly that.
And you were one of the first, or one of few at the time, the players of mixed heritage to break through into the Malaysian national team. Was that a difficult process? Because, I mean, I imagine it's very different now. Like, Malaysia is quite a multicultural place.
No, mate, like, it was horrible. My first experience with the national team was not nice at all. There was me, myself and Brendan Gann were the first two to sort of come through. And Brendan came on a little bit later. So the first call up, I was by myself and I couldn't really speak the language. And, you know, I went into the digs for the summer. We had like a summer tour. We went to Japan for a month and then we played obviously Barca and Chelsea. So I remember getting my call. The gaffer called me up. He said, look, I'm going to call you up for the summer, etc. And, you know, I was buzzing. I didn't really know what to expect, you know, national football, etc. So I was buzzing. But I remember turning up to the digs and no one would speak to me, and we had rooms, so we'd share the rooms, we'd have three people in the room, and I was by myself for the first week. And I remember boys coming into the room, you know, that were checking into the digs, and they'll literally open the door, look at me, and just shut the door. And I was like, whoa, like, hang on a minute. So like, I was literally by myself for like the first 2 weeks. It was only until a player called Ruben, who could speak English, came in a bit later, because I think he was away, and he came in a bit late, and he came straight into the room, you know, made me feel at home. But I remember my first couple of sessions, they were trying to smash me. Like you can tell they were really trying to like injure me and stuff, you know. And then went away to Japan. And me being quite, like, I'm very vocal on the pitch. Like, you know, coming from England, like, it's one of the things I learned as a young, you've got to speak, you've got to talk. Mm. And I'd scream at the boys, but not in a bad way, but like, you know, even little things like, come on, lads, come on, you can do better than that. But they see it differently. They see it as like criticism. Gaffer had to have a meeting solely just for me. And he had to explain to the boys that, you know, my culture's a bit different. And when I'm shouting and stuff on the pitch, it's not in a negative way. And I just remember sitting there like, oh my God, these boys must hate me. Yeah. Absolutely hate me.
Yeah, I only told them to press.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I remember it was when I first made my debut, and I had a decent game to be fair on my debut. I started getting a little bit of respect from like the big boys. And, you know, It was a weird vibe, because it was a bit like, you know, they speak about the England team when you had obviously Scholes, Beckham, Lampard, etc. Yeah. And they always ask, why didn't that generation win anything? And there was them stories of people going into the digs and everyone was separate. You know, you had like Chelsea on one table, Arsenal on one table. It was a lot like that. So you had these players, like legend players that have been there for years, and that, you know, they had their own culture, they had their own team. And anyone new that came in, they were a bit like, nah, jog on. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
No, I just remember saying, I remember going into the crying and going into the gaffer's office and I wanted to leave. Crying, call my agent up saying, I don't want to be here. Like, I'd rather just go back to my club and just, you know, have my holiday, have my time off. You know, I don't feel good. And gaffer at the time, Raja Kopal, said, look, just stick it out. I understand. Look, just give it a go. And my agent at the time said, yeah, as well, just try to get out. And yeah, I managed to stay. And obviously then I played Chelsea and Barca, things changed.
How different is it now then for like younger lads? Like, now you're a more senior player in that Malaysian squad. How different is it for them coming in if they're of a similar background?
Mate, massively different. You know, you've got so many mixed boys in the setup now. And it's a good contrast between the locals and the mixed heritage boys. And it's not divided as much, nowhere near as much as what it was before. And it feels more like a team now, a lot more as a team. You know, I introduce initiations now for the boys that come in. That was never a thing. So you never had to sing a song or anything. So I introduce initiations, just, you know, little things like that. They just build team morale and team spirit within the camp. And, you know, we've got a coach, Tan, who is very multicultural, you know, and he makes sure all the boys gel together. It's just a whole different vibe now. It's just a whole, complete different vibe for anyone coming in, which is good.
Has that changed it on the pitch as well?
Yeah. I mean, the results speak for itself, you know. Like we just missed out on the World Cup qualification this year by like 2 points, and we've got such a strong group of lads. And I think it's changing the Malaysian league. You know, there's a lot more talent coming through into the league with your foreigners, with the mixed heritage boys and players getting passports and so on.
Yeah. And in 2018, you decided to retire, returning to the UK after many years in Malaysia. Can you talk us through what was sort of going on in your career at that point, and how were you dealing with life in general to lead you to making that decision? Because I imagine that couldn't have been easy to step away from the game.
Yeah, it was difficult, mate. Like, when I first signed in Malaysia, I signed for a sort of small team, Sarawak, and then I managed to obviously sign for one of the biggest teams in Southeast Asia, Johor. And I was there for 6 seasons, and you know, the first 2 seasons were great, but when you're at this at Johor, you know, it's all about winning. There's a lot of pressure, you know, even a draw is counted as a loss. And it was a great, you know, it's a great, great club. The facilities and stuff is an absolute joke. Like, I guarantee even Premier League clubs, some Premier League clubs won't have the facilities that Johor have. And what the Prince has done for Johor is amazing. But for me personally, I was at a bit of a torrid time because I was riddled with injuries. I had my slip disc, had that operation, come back, like I'd tear my quad, I'd come back from that, I'd have tendonitis on both my knees. And it was just a bit of a torrid time. And it was, you know, I was there for 6 long years, and every season people would ask, are juniors not playing again, bench warmer, etc. But in the background, I was just dealing with so much like stress. I was alone, you know, and I had a great contract, which is obviously I'm very grateful for, but you know, money doesn't buy everything. I was away from my friends, my family for so long, and you know, coming in from games where I could barely walk because of my back, you know, having to take cortisone injections into my spine just to be able to play. And you know, it sort of got to the end of my tether mentally. There was only so much, you know, I could take, and I just wanted to go home and just have a break and be with my friends and be with my family and just sort of refresh my mind mentally, completely out of football. Which was, you know, you said it was a difficult decision at the time, but I felt like it was the right decision because I felt like if I would have carried on and left Johor and signed to another team, I wouldn't have had that same spark and love that I had coming back into football again. I felt like I needed to fall in love with the game again. You know, I sort of fell out of love completely. You know, I was didn't want to go into training because I knew I couldn't, you know, like on the sidelines watching the team. I was just bored and sick. Really, really sick mentally. And, you know, when you start, you know, like I said to you, when you're a kid, you love football. You play every day, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, you know, you don't care. And then when it got to a stage when I decided, you know, I didn't even feel good going into training, it was when I was like, nah, like, I can't do this. I need to go home and be with my family and my friends.
Was there anything that you were scared of, though, when you're leaving football, when you're coming back home? I know you said it was, you felt like it was the right thing to do, but was there anything sort of sitting in the back of your mind?
Nah, do you know what? Nothing like that. I was so excited to take a break. I was so excited to take a break and start new opportunities. You know, my personality is I like to have fresh starts and go and, you know, have new opportunities. And I decided to, you know, try business and have a business venture back home, which was going really well pre-COVID. And then, you know, COVID hit, and I based my life on like 5 pillars in life. So, you know, relationships, families, your health, wellness, and families, and like money, obviously, finance. And slowly after I retired, these pillars started coming down one by one without me noticing. And then when I lost my last pillar, was when I realized that, oh my God, like, what have I done? You know, it sort of makes you look back and reflect on all the money I spunked, you know, on stupid stuff. But when I look back at it, I'm glad I did it because, you know, you learn from these mistakes. And, you know, after 2 years of thinking I was financially secure of investments, etc., losing all this money, I was like, wow, like, I'm so far off where I want to be. And I basically had nothing. I went from having everything in my life to having nothing, absolutely nothing.
I've heard you speak about before working on site after that contrast from like playing professionally to then going back to working on site. That whole that whole situation, I imagine they were, that was a very bitter pill to swallow, but equally, do you think it grounded you at all? Because like you said, you didn't realise those pillars were falling down. Did you almost sort of, I know it's obviously not ideal circumstances, but did you need them to come down to realise that there was work to do?
1,000,000%. I feel like everything that happened in my life definitely happened for a reason, because, you know, especially my time at Johor, I definitely lost myself in the sense of I was going out, I was spending my money. I lost who my real mates were. You know, I was making friends with people that wanted me to spend money. You know, oh yeah, mate, come to this club, you know, get the tables, et cetera, all this sort of stuff. And I was in that world for a good 5 years, you know, and I was so lost into what was important in my life, which was, you know, my relationship, my family, my friends that actually mean something to me. So especially when I lost everything, I realized who was actually there for me, like really, really there for me. And then, you know, my mate was the one who offered me, you know, this job on site because, you know, it was good money. He didn't have to, you know, I had no labouring skills whatsoever. And he put me on, you know, a good wedge, good, well enough to be able to survive back in the UK. My best mate put me up in his house, in the room, you know, like these are the things, you know, my ego had to take a battering because I was so egotistical and I lived with my ego, and the ego can be your worst enemy. You know, I didn't think about anything before. And when I managed to, you know, I had complete ego death, you know, I was living in my mate's flat. This is a guy that they've seen, that they used to look up to in the sense of, you know, Junior will look after us, he'll pay for this, he'll pay for that. And I literally couldn't. And like, I had to take that step back and realise what was important in my life. And it definitely grounded me, mate. It definitely grounded me. Not to say I enjoyed it,
Yeah. So how did you start to like build yourself back up then? Because I imagine like your morale would have been pretty low. Like you said, your ego's just been battered. But your ego being battered, that's one of those things sometimes you don't realise that's a good thing until like later down the line. So how did you eventually start to build up your own self-confidence and eventually like make the decision to start playing again?
Yeah, I mean, it was a breakup that absolutely killed me. The breakup from my last relationship was, she was my last pillar that I had left, basically. And I didn't realise. And then when she'd left, I was gone. So I moved into my mate's house and, you know, I was absolutely, this is before I started working on site. I did not know what I was doing in my life. And I remember going for a run and, you know, only a few people know this. I ran past the Esher train station and I was on the bridge at the train station. And there was a split second where I thought, fucking hell, like, I've lost everything. What have I done? Like, is it really worth me living anymore? Like, can't believe I've done this. And then I jogged back home to Ollie's house, Ollie Clements. I jogged back to his and I sat underneath a tree for like a good hour, good hour, and just reflected on everything, like everything. And then I started working and I made that decision then and there to start working with a life coach, Josh Connolly, who was recommended to me before from one of my good friends, Ollie Scott. And he's amazing, like completely amazing. I remember messaging him, telling him about my suicidal thoughts. And he said, I don't think I'm the guy that you should be speaking to about this because, you know, he's a life coach. He's not, you know, someone that deals with suicide, et cetera. He said, here's a number that you can speak to. And I said, nah, like, I want to speak to you. Like, so I felt comfortable with him, you know, I knew him from before and I knew that he could help me with what he's been through in his past, you know, and where he's come.
Yeah.
So I started working with him and from then forward, you know, he sort of built my confidence up. We stripped back everything from like my childhood trauma to what I went through in my relationship, why I did the things I did. And it was never, I didn't blame myself. It was all reasoning to why I did these things. And it was important for me to understand why I did these things in my past and to understand why I did them, write them down on paper and forget, you know, forgive myself for these things and start to rebuild myself slowly, step by step. Started working with him, you know, started working on site, grounding myself with, you know, real humans, real stories, you know, seeing my friends again, you know, starting to enjoy football at Met Police again. And I had a conversation with Ollie Clements, one of my best friends, and I said, I'm only 28. Like, what is stopping me from going back to playing full time, you know, in Malaysia? And that was when I made the decision to call Scott. And I said, look, I'm coming back. And he said, you know, it's difficult. You've had 2 years out. I said, listen, I'm coming back. Just give me an opportunity, get me a chance, and I'll prove you wrong. So yeah, he said, look, fly to Malaysia in November. So I flew out, done my quarantine, spoke to my old club, Johor, you know, reluctant to take me back. Loads of clubs were reluctant to take me back. And it was sort of, again, like a kick in the teeth, like, fuck, like, come on, what I've done for, you know, the country, et cetera, for the national team, like, you know, just give me a chance. I was probably in the best shape of my life as well. You know, I'd worked so hard in this sort of 6 month period to be in the best shape to come back. You know, I worked with Ollie and another PT back home. So I knew I was ready because I knew I had that feel, that fire in my belly again to have that opportunity. So yeah, it was good.
I want to rewind a little bit there. Back to, you said you were by on the bridge over the train station, over the train track. Sorry, that split second where you felt suicidal. What sort of thoughts were going through your head at that point? Was there like anything specific that kept coming up? And what? There's not really a way of asking this politely. What stopped you doing it?
My thoughts were, I was just blaming myself for everything. Everything was blame. Like, I was just blaming myself for losing my money. I was blaming myself for, you know, my relationships, my family, and relationships with my girlfriend at the time. Like, I was blaming myself for losing everything. And I just thought, there's nothing left. Like, you know, I've got no one around me. Like, I thought in my head, I was like, no one loves me around me. Like, you know, I've fucked everything up. I'm always going to keep fucking up. And then it was just like I was jogging, I was listening to a YouTube inspirational video, you know, one of them cringy ones. But, you know, it actually helped me because I was listening to what Eric Thomas was saying at the time in my headphones, and it just made me spur on, like, nah, this can't be the end. Like, this can't be the end. I know there's so much more, and there has to be more reason into why this happened. And I'm a firm believer of everything does happen for a reason.
Yeah, fair enough. So now it seems like you're really eloquent and you speak about these things really well. I imagine you weren't always like that. Has the honest footballer, has doing that served that purpose for you? Has that helped to do that?
Yeah, I was, a lot of my friends will tell you that I always had a stigma about mental health, in the sense of I never really believed in it. I think being an athlete and being in sports, you're sort of built around having, you know, such strong mental thoughts and being able to block out any emotions on game day, etc., to be able to perform. And you sort of bring that into everyday life, which is quite difficult to switch out of, because that's the things I'll do. I'd switch off any emotion and I'll be like, yeah, I'm fine, I'm cool. Like, there's nothing wrong with me. Like, there's absolutely nothing wrong with me. I'm fine. I'm mentally strong enough to deal with this.
Yeah.
But when you sort of bottle that up, it only builds up inside you without you realizing. Until one day, obviously, you know, like I had that experience, it all comes out slowly. So I think The Honest Footballer was built upon me being honest about, you know, my emotions, my feelings during my playing time in football, because that's what I never used to do. Fans never used to be able to see how I felt after games and what things affect me, my injuries affect me, how comments could affect me, you know, how having a bad game could affect me mentally, being injured could affect me outside of football. You know, I think a lot of people see athletes as robots with no emotion sometimes. End of the day, we're working, you know, it's a job, and, you know, we still come home, we still have feelings and emotions.
Yeah. And for anyone that doesn't know, The Honest Football, like, it is what it says on the tin. You document your ups and downs in a way that, like you said, players don't normally do. At what point did you decide that The Honest Football was going to be a thing? Like, I know on one of the videos you say it was born in this hotel room wherever you were. Was it literally like that, or is it something that you built?
Yeah, no,
you
built it was like, yeah, obviously I spoke out before I come back to football professionally. I did a video on mental health and the importance of obviously your mental health outside of sport, and especially life after sports. I don't think there's enough done for athletes outside of sports, outside of the sporting environment, at home, etc. And a lot of footballers don't speak about it, you know. And I've seen so many of my teammates go down so many routes and, you know, tell me they're fine when I know they're not, and never being able to open up about it. So I was literally in quarantine for 2 weeks, as you can imagine, just documenting sort of my quarantine stand. I was like, do you know what? I want to do this differently this time. Like, I want to be able to document my career so I can also look back at my career and, you know, have things to remember, have things, oh yeah, I remember when that, you know, that was a really horrible time for me. And I wanted fans to be able to see the real me. And I think it's important because, like I said before, people didn't, you know, I also had this separation against the fans. You know, I'd almost had this mentality of like, fuck the fans, like, you know, but I'd never let them allow them to see who I fully am as a person, not a player, as a person outside of football. So I wanted to document it and just, you know, I just wanted to do it for myself at first, and then it sort of picked up, and I realized I was helping young athletes, and, you know, I've had lovely messages from a lot of people with what I'm doing, and it's been great so far.
All the comments that you see in those videos are always thoughtful. They're always very kind and supportive. But I've heard you speak before, and I know you deleted like social media accounts in the past, because social media, as we all know, and it was the case for yourself, it's sort of detrimental to your mental health, and it gives you a platform to sometimes chase your ego if that's the mind space that you're in at the time. But has The Honest Footballer changed your relationship with social media now?
Massively. My relationship with social media before was so poisonous, where I didn't get validation from things that, you know, I seeked. I should have been getting validation from my friends, my family, my relationship at the time, but I was seeking validation from people I don't even know online, trying to front my lifestyle, get these likes, etc. And, you know, when you're trying to live up to that lifestyle is when you start spending money stupidly, and, you know, you're buying the cars, you're going out all these places, etc., all for the gram. And it can be so, so poisonous. And, you know, what social media taught me when I deleted, I had to come off social media for 6 months, is it really doesn't matter. You know, it is literally a facade. Social media is a complete facade. And unless you're trying, you know, you're documenting your true self on your social media, which, you know, 99% of people probably don't do. And I can understand why, because of everything you see on social media, it's fake. You know, it is fake. And it is dangerous. You know, I remember I'd spend hours on my phone and editing pictures and stuff. When I'm at dinner, you know, with my friends, I'd just be on my phone, on my Instagram, and, you know, DMing, etc., all this sort of stuff. Yeah. But obviously creating The Honest Footballer has given me a platform where I can share my true experiences and my true self, and, you know, getting great feedback from people and stuff has changed my relationship with social media completely. And it, you know, it is all about how you use it. You know, you look at what's happened with the England players getting racially abused. You know, it's a platform, if you're on, where it allows people to do this. It allows people to do this, and it can be a very dangerous place.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But I'm really glad that you don't have that toxic relationship with it anymore. Because yeah, you're right. It's awful. Like, you just, like, you're chasing this like online dragon. You're like, it's never enough. You get like, I don't know, whatever, however many likes you get on a picture, and the next one doesn't do as well. You're like, oh fuck, what happened there?
But
like you said, it's when you step away from it, you're like, oh shit, this actually isn't real life. It doesn't matter. It's completely irrelevant.
Exactly.
What about, since you started documenting your ups and downs, I imagine for you sometimes watching back some of those clips that it might not be the easiest of things, but what have you learned about yourself since you started The Honest Footballer?
Just being able to be more emotionally vulnerable with people, you know, and actually being, not being scared of, you know, crying, or not being scared to tell people what I'm actually feeling, which is what I was before. I used to always be scared about being judged. And it's definitely just taught me to be vulnerable and emotionally vulnerable. It actually makes you stronger as a human being if you can be vulnerable with people, etc., and not, you know, try not to think so much about how people see you and how people perceive you. As long as you're giving yourself 100% every day, and you're giving your best to life, whatever that is, you know, no one's perfect. Then, you know, that's all that matters, really, in my eyes.
Yeah, I think a lot of people should take a leaf from that book. I completely agree. But when you started those vlogs, was it scary to open up? Because, like you said, you know, you're worried about what other people think of you, but you also know that you should do it. You know that it will benefit you in the long run.
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes it's hard to get every bit of content, you know, when, because, you know, sometimes you just want to be by yourself and you can't document it, you know, as much as I try to document everything, sometimes you can't document everything, you know, with football, it's just, your emotions are like this sometimes. Like, you're coming home from a loss, and maybe I might have had a shit game. Sometimes I just don't want to even think about anyone else and just just be by myself and not focus on myself. So it can be difficult at times, but you know, I try to get most of what I can. Obviously when Gaffer's screaming his lungs out in the change room at half time, can't get that in.
I'll keep my phone away for that one. Since you've started like this, I don't know what you'd call it, maybe like a self-development journey, like you sought professional help and you've started being a bit more open about these things, do you have like any new habits that maybe help you with like your mental clarity and wellness? Like I've seen you speak about meditating before.
No, it's a weird one. Like I always had good habits. Even back when I sort of lost myself, you know, I was always, you know, I was reading a lot, you know, meditating every day, you know, affirmations, etc. Always had good habits. I think habits is it's a difficult one, because to maintain good habits, you have to, you know, sometimes you have to be in a good environment. And when you're not in a good environment, you lose them habits, you know. So when I was back home in England and I lost my job, lost my investments, the shop went down, my business, etc., my environment became very bad. My relationship was toxic. So then my environment became really bad, and I wouldn't do the things that I knew I should be doing. Yeah. If that makes sense, to that I know benefits me, benefits my mental health, you know, breath work, etc. And then as soon as I started playing football again, and I realized that I need to install these habits that I know these habits that help me, etc. But it's funny, because now I'm in a good environment, you know, it's so easy for me to do. And I have spoken about it before, and I understand, you know, when you go on these podcasts, etc., people say, oh, you have to do these habits to get better and so on. And it's so like in your face, but it's all about your environment that you're in at the time. And as long as, you know, one of the main things I think is important is to have the right people around you, you know, the right friends that are always going to support you, your family that are going to support you through the bad times and the good times, is probably the most key thing. Because you aren't going to be able to do the habits, daily habits every day. It's just not realistic. It's not realistic at all.
Yeah, good point as well. Like I've gone through stages where I've tried to instill so many like good habits, like in the hope that it'll benefit me. And that in itself becomes fucking daunting. Like it's exhausting to keep up with them. It's like you're caught in this like self-development fucking circle, like just running around. It's brutal. And it's even the same with... I've meditated for like quite a few years. Like it's just like a normal part of my day now. Like even then, sometimes everyone talks about mindfulness. Sometimes being mindful is the last thing I want to do. Do you know what I mean? Like you're so like trapped by your own mindfulness. Like you can't just let stuff go without noticing it. It's
pain in the ass.
But anyway, back onto your that's my vent over, by the way.
That's good. vent all you want.
Back onto your playing career, because you're on this like an exciting path again since coming back to the game. And I've seen like the one part of your vlogs where you're understandably struggling at one point in your hotel quarantine coming into Thailand during Christmas and New Year. It seemed to really break you down. That's a difficult time to be away from people anyway, let alone literally fucking locked up in a hotel. Is that the most difficult thing about playing abroad? Is it being away from the people?
Yeah, I think that time, obviously I'd done 2 weeks quarantine in Malaysia, and then last minute I got a deal in Thailand, and you know, I again relished on a new opportunity, never played in the Thai league, you know, new language, new culture, and then I went straight into another quarantine in Thailand. So I've done 2 weeks in Malaysia, then another 2 weeks, so a whole month in quarantine in a hotel. And obviously, like you said, it was over Christmas and New Year's, and I think it triggered the past of being alone. And it's like it was a massive trigger of like, oh, like, am I really doing this again? Like, you know where it led you last time. Like, you were alone, you were depressed, you were away from family and friends during these special, you know, these moments that people, obviously some people take for granted, you know. And I think being a player that goes abroad, yeah, it's probably one of the hardest things to obviously fathom, is to be away from your family and friends. But I had that, like I said earlier, I had that little fire in my belly that sort of kept me going this time, was like, nah, like I'm excited. This is one of the sacrifices I'm making for a long-term gain. You know, short-term sacrifice for a long-term gain. So, I mean, it wasn't easy, but it was sort of exciting at the time as well.
What about adjusting to life in Thailand then? Like we've said, Malaysia is very multicultural. You yourself, like, you're from a mixed heritage background. Has that helped you with that sort of transition into this culture?
Yeah, much easier this time around. Came straight in, gelled with the team, and in Thailand, I'm sort of, in Malaysia, I was seen as a local player. Even though I was mixed heritage, I was still seen as a local player because I had the Malaysian passport. But in Thailand, I'm seen as a foreigner. So I'm one of the foreign boys. So immediately you feel a lot more respected by the boys, and you're there to make the team stronger and make the team better. You know, you're going to be one of the starting 11s, etc. So it was a great feeling, and I felt like I had to prove myself again, which was also a very good thing, because I felt like if I would have gone back into the setup and sort of lived upon what I've done in the past, it wouldn't have been the same. So it was like I had a new opportunity to show myself and show who I am in Thailand. And then obviously that will then replenish in what goes on in Malaysia, because obviously they keep up with all the Malaysians playing abroad, etc. So it was a great, great, great feeling to obviously have my first season in Chonburi.
Love to see it. I used to go watch Thai Port.
Good team, mate.
A lot of money. I found it funny how involved like the owner was. Like, she'd be on the sidelines, telling players what to do. But on game day, especially in Thailand, with most games are evening games, right? How do you keep yourself like calm and motivated throughout the day? But you know, there's a balance there. You want to be relaxed, but you also need to be full of energy when the time comes.
Yeah, it's weird. Obviously, I went from, in Malaysia, they play a lot. In Malaysia, they play at 9. So 8:45, 9 at night. And then obviously I went back to England. We had like 12 o'clock kickoffs or 3 o'clock kickoffs. Had to get used to that. And then going back to Thailand, they play a little bit earlier. So we start kickoffs normally at 6:30 or 7:30. So it's not too bad. But, you know, just my match day routine is I wake up when my body wants me to wake up. So I don't have an alarm on my match days. I wake up, I'll go for a morning walk, then have like a stretch, meditate, and then I'll have like a breakfast, so like an oatmeal breakfast, and then I'll have a pasta bake, which I make the night before. Always make a pasta bake the night before for game day. I don't know why, I always do. And then I have my pasta bake at like 4, and then, you know, by that time, I'm just chilling, mate. I'm literally just relaxing on game day, you know, whether that's playing COD or just sitting on my sofa watching Netflix and then getting myself ready. I tend not to sleep in the day at all. So I make sure I get, you know, a good amount of sleep the night before, wake up when my body needs to, and then try not to nap in the day, because I feel for my body, when I do nap in the day before games, I just feel lethargic going into match day.
Mm-hmm. How different is your like pre-game sort of rituals compared to some of the Thai players? I imagine like diet's going to be quite different when compared to what you're used to.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I haven't seen them outside of obviously what they do on match days, but I can imagine they're a lot more probably relaxed on what they eat and stuff. Like, I need to make sure I turning 30, you know, you should see my supplement drawer now. I've got probably 20 boxes of pills, you know, all my supplements that I need to take, etc. And need to make sure I get my stretches in and make sure my body's ready. You know, even at training day, I'm always in an hour and a half before training, doing my mobility work before going into training. You know, some of the boys rock up 10 minutes before and just train fully. Mate, listen, you're going to feel that in a few years. All the young boys, they haven't got a clue. They're like, nah, I can turn up, just train. And so trust me, I used to be like that. And I'm, you know, ended up nearly being a cripple.
Yeah, they're out on the singers straight after training.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, Junior, we've touched on loads of different topics here, but it's been a really interesting conversation. I want to round it off with something I call long ball questions. These are basically an assorted mix of straight to the point questions, but I want us to focus a bit more on the positive self, because I know we've spoken about a lot of deep stuff. It can be a bit draining about. I know how it is. I've just got 3 questions lined up for you. What would you say is the highest point in your career so far, or a career highlight?
A career highlight would be coming back to football, you know, going against all odds. People saying, nah, no chance, he's coming back. He's lost it, no chance. And then coming back, being in the first 11 at Chonburi, and then taking them to the final of the FA Cup. You know, we survived relegation. You know, I joined halfway through the season where they were bottom three and we had to survive relegation. And I think football is very important in that sense. I like to be a player that fights for something. whether it's relegation, you know, I'd hate to be in a team where you're just mid-table every year, you know, nothing to fight for. So we survived relegation and then scoring in the semi-final against Buriram, which is, you know, a massive, massive team in Thailand, and scoring the winner and getting Chonburi to the final was probably one of the highest moments of my career. It was amazing. Amazing feeling.
Unreal stuff. Next question. What three things do you value most in your life?
Now? I'd say my job, which is, you know, football, enjoying football, my friends and my family.
Nice.
Without a doubt, I'll put them first now, 100%.
Great stuff. And the last question, you can list as many things as you want here, or it can just be one. But what do you love about yourself?
Yeah. Oh, mate, let me just get my booklet out. I've got a long, massive list.
Yeah, here's one I made earlier.
I love about myself the opportunity, like the ability to pick myself back up. Pick myself back up when I'm down. I think that's one of my definite strong points. Because I've had a lot of downs in my life, and I've always managed to come out on the brighter side. I'm very optimistic. I always believe, you know, things are always going to be, the grass will always be greener on the other side. When there's a rain cloud, the sun will always be behind. So yeah, I think that's one of my key things I love about myself, is how I can pick myself up when the times are low.
Top man. That's class stuff, mate. Really enjoyed this chat. I hope you have as well, mate.
No, thank you for having me on, mate. I really appreciate it. You know, obviously reached out on The Honest Footballer because I do want to speak about it a lot more with people that, you know, like you're doing in Football and Feelings, is you're opening players up, etc. And it's great to be on, mate. I really appreciate it.
No worries at all. I'll put in the show notes, you'll be able to find links to go find all Junior stuff. He's The Honest Footballer. Search that on YouTube as well. To the listener, thank you for joining me on this episode. I'll see you again soon. Cheers.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.